And I felt that my background, being the fact that I was kicked out of school when I was in third grade, they told me that I had an IQ of 72 and would not be capable of doing any further education. And after I started working in various unskilled and semi-skilled areas, me, I could accept was dumb. But her and all the other kids that I knew, I couldn't accept that they were all dumb. And yet, it just seems they were just being felled right and left. Failures.
This is audio of Mary Hilaire recorded during a recruitment meeting on the Colville Indian Reservation in 1973.
At one time, I decided that somebody had to go and find out about it. And the only way we could do that is to get into the higher education system. It took me about 10 years and finally got into school. Started my college education, and it was really great. It was fun. It was more funner than picking strawberries or raspberries or hoeing hops, trimming hops. And that just sort of made me drunk. And I wanted to go on and on and on.
I conducted an interview with former senior academic dean and senior scholar Barbara Smith to better understand the Native American Studies program created by Mary Hilaire. I was having difficulty understanding because very little of its history has been put into print, despite the fact that there is a full archive at the Evergreen State College dedicated to Hilaire's work on the program from 1972 up until her passing 10 years later. I was looking for some kind of founding document to give me a footing on where the program started and how it changed over time. Barbara Smith relayed matter-of-factly that they didn't have mission statements in those days. Quote, the faculty didn't work with the dean to design their programs. The teachers were responsible for creating their courses, and that's what Mary did. Faculty members being empowered to create their own programs free of the dean's influence would have been perfectly in line with the progressive values that Evergreen was founded on when it first opened in 1971. Letting a program evolve independently is one thing when it is a class on ethnopharmacology or the oral history of the Sierra Nevada Club as featured on the 1972 course list, but a very different thing when it was Mary Hilaire's vision for the creation of a new higher education system for the Native American people. As Evergreen Literature Professor Thad Kurtz recalled in 1987,
In the conversations I had with people about Mary, one thing that struck me was the sense of her repeating over and over again that she was engaged in a process, exploring, trying to discover ways of doing something that had never been successfully done before. That is, trying to figure out what higher education for Native Americans ought to be, how to use useful pieces of Western traditional education and interface with that, how to create an institution within Native American traditions. Somebody told me, she once said, that the West had been working on this for 2,000 years, ever since Plato, that you had to figure that it was going to take 20 years at least to think it out for Native American communities.
Mary joined Evergreen in 1972 as the first female faculty member of the college and implemented the Native American Studies program 1 year later. According to a retrospective of the program written by Professor Dave Hitchens, the manifesto was signed by the four faculty members and does seem to have served the purpose of a mission statement. He mentions Mary's four principles of the program: music, dance, talk, and art. Mary expands on the first principle.
So music is our first effort. Response, human response to sound. You know, even if it's an old stupid machine clanging, all of a sudden, and it's clanging in rhythm, you're going like this, or you're stomping your feet in the rhythm of the machine. But you hear, you respond to with your body.
This, again, is Thad Kurtz.
I see the following shifts over the on the basis of these interviews over the 12 years of the program's history so far, from 75 to now. gone from being a program primarily for Native American students to a program that enrolls nearly all white students. In the very beginning, it was exclusively a program for Native American students, then partly for legal reasons and partly to expand, strengthen, support.
The program was intended to be exclusively Native American in both faculty and student base. Mary Hilaire recalled in an audio tape from 1978.
During the first years of Native American studies, the program came under a great deal of unfounded criticism and misunderstanding by the administration and the faculty of Evergreen. Many of the non-Indian students hearing and associating with the students from Native American studies started to demand entrance into the Native American student studies program.
The project was also intended to be at least one-third off-campus by way of reservation schools. There were seven locations that went around the coast of the Puget Sound on the Sklallam, Clallam, Nisqually, Muckleshoot, Quinault, Skokomish, and Makah Indian communities. Thad Kurtz recounts Mary's extreme schedule to make this off-campus vision a reality.
There are lots of terrific stories about Mary and the other faculty getting up at 3 in the morning to drive to Nia Bay and spend all day in Nia Bay talking to people and driving back to Olympia in the middle of the night.
In the first year, Allaire was given enough funding for four faculty members: Mary Nelson, Cruz Esquivel, Daryl Fair, and herself. Esquivel and Nelson were from the Colville tribe, and Fair shared Hilaire's Lummi background. Rather than focusing on post-high school graduates, Hilaire's program was primarily designed with working adults in mind. Hilaire developed a structure for the program where adults could apply their previous life experience to equivalency in academic credit.
If these people come, if some of the older people who have the strength come and say, I have had this many years working in baskets, and one of these instructors helped those people write this out in what the whites call educational terms. See, if a person works with six people over, say, 2 years period, they have learned both the techniques and the procedures. So we can say over here that this person has the equivalent of a graduate course in group dynamics.
The archive that I have culled most of this exhibit from is known as the Mary Ellen Hilaire Papers, 1950 through 1983, though printed material makes up the smallest segment of the archive. The majority of the collection is audio-visual. Out of 2,142 audio cassettes, 44 audio tapes, 64 videos, and 1,518 slides, there is only one box of text documents in the entire collection. Thad Kurtz explains Hilaire's obsessive recording this way.
Whether it was working or not, she wanted everything recorded because she thought it was perfectly possible that things would happen that you didn't realize mattered for 5 years, and that you then were going to need to go back and be able to look at again in order to use them and profit from them.
As a faculty member, Mary would send out her quarterly reports and long dictaphone recordings sent to the dean's office rather than inside written reports. The recordings range from 45 minutes to 2 hours in length and would vary from dry, budgetary lists to emotive departures about the importance of the program to the future of the Native American people. In addition to recording meetings, lectures, and notes, Mary also recorded the majority of her phone conversations that she took in her office on campus.
Out, because if they sent it out that way, it can really turn people off, not
yes.
only minorities, but some whites.
Can you hang on a minute?
Okay. Hello?
I know you're on the phone, but call Betty Beeman, President's Office, 6100, when you're done.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
The President's Office.
Oh.
No, it's, they can wait. I've waited on them this long. I hope I haven't waited too long. See, there were 20 people. In fact, originally there were 40 people.
As a researcher, I'm not sure if the other people in the phone conversations were unaware that they were being recorded or if it was common knowledge that this was one of her habits. I am also unsure what the incentive was behind this practice, but it feels very reminiscent of the Watergate scandal that was culturally dominant while the program was going through its formative years.
How's Nixon this morning? I see you got a newspaper there.
Oh, isn't he supposed to be...
Is he still president yet?
they'll never find enough.
He says, I'm not going to fail.
Yeah. He probably won't.
Yeah, there's no way that a white can fail.
Throughout quarterly reports, reservation lectures, and program meetings, Mary refused to attend Evergreen faculty meetings. Mary Nelson and Daryl Fair are either silent or absent. The only vocal member of the founding faculty is Cruz Esquivel, a music and philosophy professor with Jesuit training who begins to balance Mary's and Tone's speeches with his measured, trenchant contributions to the meetings. In this excerpt, he explains the program's goals for giving students the ability to navigate both white and Native American values.
Okay, these white values, I'm not saying the kids are going to have to learn to live by these. They're going to have to learn them to be able to manipulate within this world. Okay, and the eventual product would be a popular term that's used now, biculturalism. This would be an individual who can operate in both worlds.
The content of what I found in the audio tapes is complicated. In the first year of the program, faculty members were published accusing the dean and college faculty of being, quote, racist bigots. This accusation was consistent throughout my research from 1970 to 1988. When there were white speakers attending the meetings, such as librarian and archivist Malcolm Stilson, he was introduced as, quote, one of the good ones. Cruz Esquivel relates a similar story in 1973 about being talked about by a white faculty member as if he were not Native American.
Speaking of teachers, when I was teaching, during our in-service, the whole district got together for 3 or 4 days. And one of the new fellows asked the guy, kind of like this from me, he says, well, what about the Indian students? And the guy says, oh, those Indian students, he says, I've tried everything imaginable, and they just won't learn. And this is what all these new teachers within earshot were hearing before they even stepped into the classroom. And the guy had forgotten I was an Indian, which they did quite often. And I said, Floyd, how can you say that? And was he ever embarrassed? And he taught in my school. But he was telling the guys, don't try anything. They just can't learn, or won't learn, is what he said.
Mary also holds grudges against other tribes. Towards the end of her life, she obsessively recalled an interaction with a member of an Alaskan tribe that told her that she had her work cut out for her trying to obtain funding for such, quote, plain, unglamorous Indian people in the Pacific Northwest. In the midst of this complicated environment that we hear on the tapes, there also emerges a force of character in Hilaire that gives the listener a remote sense of the strength that enabled Mary to manifest her vision of a system of higher education for Native American people. This vision was, at various times, at odds with the student body, the college administration, state agencies, and, in her opinion, her own Lummi values. Creating the program also required her to act in defiance of nearly a century of substandard educational practices implemented on the indigenous people of the Pacific Northwest.
Unfortunately, because the treaties, I really put a very firm stamp on that time, because at that time, the adult Indians started to be recognized as children. You know, you read the text of the treaty and they're called children. In fact, the first couple words is my children. And then throughout history, the whites have been encouraged to see Indian adults as children.
Mary Hilaire was born on February 7, 1927, to Joseph and Edna Hilaire on the Lummi Reservation outside of Bellingham, Washington. That same year, Joseph and Frank Hilaire, Mary's grandfather, testified in the Duwamish et al. Tribes of Indians versus United States of America. The case disputed land stolen by the government in violation of the Point Elliott Treaty. Mary's father was 32 years old, and Frank Hilaire was 82, old enough to remember being a child when the treaty was written and ratified in the 1850s. The government was equally negligent in their violation of the 14th Act of the treaty, which promised Indian schools, teachers, and supplies free of charge to any tribal leader that put ink to paper. What the government offered instead was one somewhat centrally located school for all 18 reservations that the treaty created. The Tulalip Mission was located 70 miles south of Lummi Bay. The Lummi leaders petitioned the distance of the school from their reservations, citing the deaths of children both on their way to and attending the institution.
In whatever level believed in the melting pot dream of America or manifest destiny, which is being taught at one of the local schools here in Whatcom County, I feel that, and I have said many times, that the only reason why it was easy to fail children is that most of the time the white educators did not have to face Indian parents. Because with the failure of Indian children, the Indian parents' shame was so great that they very seldom asked why.
The distance of the children from their parents also allowed for the admission of overt cruelty. Superintendent Charles Buchanan used 50-pound ball and chains on children who attempted to run away. The weights would be dragged by the children for a period of 30 days as an alternative to jail. He was also discovered to club and whip children during medical procedures and as punishment for bedwetting. After annual petitions from the Lummi people, the Lummi Day School was finally constructed on dry ground in 1910, 55 years after it was promised to them in the Treaty of Point Elliott. It was a one-room school heated by a wood stove and lit by oil lamps with the capacity for 40 students. The day school was later rebuilt and expanded in 1931, where it stands today as the library for the Northwest Indian College, previously the Lummi School of Aquaculture, which Mary Hilaire helped to create.
So, my dad, in his generation, Art Humphrey and some George Ames, they worked with the State Department, striving to bring in to a more creative and a more useful way the talents that we have for fishing. And it didn't work. In the later years of my father's life, we talked much about this idea of the Lummi's resource, of the conditions of poverty among Indians in this area, of the possibility. And we approached many times the idea of a marriage between the native abilities, the native talents for fishing, and the technological skills of production.
In 1968, the State Oceanographic Commission gave the Lummi people a grant of $1,000 to survey Lummi Bay as a potential site for aquaculture, or the rearing of aquatic animals or plants for food. The survey concluded that, quote, the tidelands could be converted into a large pool with just the right depth to allow a number of fish to grow. Once the Lummi community came forward with their plans, they were immediately met with a backlash from both the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Lummi Bay Beach Association, who owned most of the property along the bay. The association attacked the Lummi aquaculture program as, quote, a waste of money and a dangerous precedent in allowing uneducated Indians to run things, Insults and accusations like these directly influenced the creation of the Lummi School of Aquaculture, so that the community could educate themselves independently instead of relying on licensing from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineering as they needed to do during the initial stages in the early 70s.
I wish I had thought of it, I would have brought some of the brochures. The very first program that I had responsibility in is called the Lummi Indian Aquaculture Program. The first fish farming program in the United States, where you have taken the talent of a native people, married it with the technology of our time. And these, you know, it's just a miracle. In 4 years, dropouts were doing work that most students in college were having a hard time doing it in 4 years. They were doing it in 1 year. They have set up their oyster hatchery. They set up a, I think it's some kind of a sea algae production for cosmetics, making something that goes in cosmetics. They have crossbred some of the indigenous
Mary Hilaire cites on many different lectures her participation in the creation of the Lummi School of Aquaculture, though I have been unable to find any supporting material around this claim. I do know that Mary graduated from Western Washington State College in 1956 and completed a master's in education 10 years later, a year before she talks about contributing to the design of the Lummi School of Aquaculture. Following the completion of Mary's master's, she talks about being hired by the Department of Education in Washington, D.C. to evaluate Native American programs across the country.
I visited about 65 universities throughout the United States last summer to evaluate the content and the interest of Native American people in what the higher education system calls Native American studies. I found, by and large, the programs were written by whites, and they were taught by whites, and they were listened to by whites.
Mary talks about being offered a job in London and the difficulty of staying in touch with Native American people.
The first job that I was offered when I got out of the University of British Columbia was a professorship at the University of London in England. And they said to me, well, you don't need your people anymore. But all through school, when I would ever get a free chance, I'd go back to my reservation and sit with as many people that will sit with me. Of course, the thing of it is, when you become educated, even your own loved ones become hostile. And a lot of the things that people said to me hurt me really bad. I had to understand that I needed them more than they needed me, and I could take this abuse. But a lot of people don't understand that.
Mary discussed how she came up with the idea for the program upon seeing the inadequacies of the pre-existing programs and returning to Washington State to put them into motion.
One group that was the first time they had ever heard Indian music by Indian people, they'd, you know, sent away, and they had about 4 or 5 records of Indian music that was put out by Smithsonian. And so all across the country I found this, and it got me to thinking. In fact, after that I was offered 2 presidential appointments. But after that trip, I was convinced that I had to come back to Washington State.
So when I got back to Evergreen State College from my year in Washington, D.C., I sort of cased the joint, and I found, as in most institutions of higher learning, that it was a hostile place to Indian people.
In 1973, when the program officially launched at Evergreen, Mary visited many of the surrounding reservations to explain her vision to tribal leaders. These recordings contain many of the most honest insights into Mary's personal history. They include accounts of being thrown out of the third grade and having the inability to read when she returned. There is also the disclosure of what may now be interpreted as dyslexia.
Because I was thrown out of school when I was in the third grade. They just let me go to school but fail all the time. And then when I went back to school, I didn't know how to read. So 2 years I had to learn a different way to get my grades. I couldn't read. And I couldn't today read. I understand material because I understand what people are doing. And if they can tell me the year that this is written, I could tell them what it's written about. And teachers have told me I never knew anybody who was so insightful. And I hadn't even read the book. But I know people.
Mary also recalled that she was an incredibly shy person until she worked in Washington, D.C. She told the small group that she was lecturing to that once she got over her insecurities around public speaking, she found herself unable to stop. In Dave Hitchens' history of the program, he cites a student from 1973 recalling, quote, "I was not used to elders talking at such length. Mary Hilaire would talk for 8 hours without stopping."
You know, a lot of people are scared when they say public speaking or speaking, even speaking. You know, speech classes used to really bug me, and yet that's what I do. I think of all the little exercises I do that best. But it scared me when it was packaged in something called speech, because there was certain kind of analytic, you know, bug kind of exercises that I didn't like. But everybody can talk.
The volume of the tapes in the collection cover nearly every facet of Mary's life between the years of 1972 to 1982. We hear Mary lecture nonstop during an 8-hour class, lead a faculty meeting where she held the floor save for 2 or 3 interjections, give a recruitment lecture at a reservation 2 hours away, and then go home to dictate reports. As with many prolific figures, when listening to the tapes, it is impossible to avoid speculating whether Mary may have somehow both been extremely involved with her community in one sense and profoundly isolated in another. Mary Hilaire was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1980 and continued to work with the program until her passing on October 2nd, 1982.
If it were not that I have been slowed down by my condition. I've had to have surgery and radiation treatments. I would not be at this time imploring you to consider the benefit you have been these past 3 years to a great number of Native American people.
One of my main areas of interest around this story is between the period of 1970 to 1971, when she chose to implement her Native American Studies program at the Evergreen State College. Considering that the program accused the administration of racism within the first year of implementation, openly joked that none of her staff wanted to be on campus, and stated, "Unless they fire me, I will never work with whites," Evergreen seems like an odd choice. Was it a matter of funding that was unavailable from the tribal universities, the first of which had only opened 3 years earlier? Was it the perceived leniency of a more liberal college that would allow the program to develop according to Mary's vision? Was it that Hilaire wanted a platform where she could reach out to many tribes instead of just the Lummi people? By the time of her passing, she was working with 12 Native American tribes in Washington and receiving Native American students from the Southwest and Northeast United States. The closest thing that I can find to an answer was in this recording from 1973 when an unidentified speaker asks, "Now, is this something that you want to do as a part of Evergreen? How are you going to fit this into it?"
I kind of had a hang up here. I figured that we paid for this. That we paid for a place in whatever system that is workable for us. In the higher education system, while not totally beneficial to anyone, can be more beneficial if we take part.
Professor Dave Hitchens described the relationship of the Native American Studies program to the Evergreen State College as an experiment within an experiment that the school had simply lost sight of. While Mary's battles with the school administration are in bold print throughout the Mary Ellen Hilaire Papers archive, there is also a current of contention between Mary and the Lummi community. Though there are no specific details of what happened, there are a few rare moments when Mary discussed her relationship with the Lummi Nation in the wake of her academic achievements.
"I have been suspected by my Indian family and friends that I succeeded academically and failed as a Lummi. I do not feel that education should do this, that it should open the opportunity on the one hand while denying the ultimate on the other. The ultimate is that the best day and the worst day in my life, I will be Lummi."
Mary's sister Pauline Hilaire wrote, "Rites Remembered, a Salish grandmother speaks on the American Indian history and the future, recalling Lummi history, politics, and fishing rights, with surprisingly little about Mary, excluding this brief aside. The foundation for Mary Ellen's Native American Studies program was our Coast Salish value system. The system has nothing to do with money, power, sex, or any form of egotism. It was a struggle to get the college to understand and accept, but they did."
There are some things that we have to take as human beings by faith. And the network, my dad used to call it the person-to-person human bridge to understanding. We don't all have to be at this point or that point or that point or the farthest point. All we have to be is in the system that works together.